Jones was initially stopped, allegedly, for not having his lights on, although there's a
dispute. How do you even get to this? The district court's district argument is that you don't have standing.
Right. I will address
that. That's jurisdictional.
That is correct. I agree with you. But I think the reason that I mentioned that is for two reasons. One, under the 14th Amendment, we believe the standing argument that the district court has issue with, and I understand their issue, deals with the 4th Amendment claim because that's the survival claim. The 14th Amendment claim does not need that specific appointment.
This is the claim for loss of child.
Interference with familial relationship.
Right.
We believe that the
question. How old is Mr. Johnson?
He was 44.
Okay. And there are at least some circuits that have suggested that after the age of majority, that this claim is no longer viable.
There are some circuits, but not the Ninth Circuit. So the Ninth Circuit, in some of the cases, and there's many more, Smith v. City of Fontana, Johnson v. Bart, Colonel v. Ridgecrest, and many others, hold that adult children, even when an adult children is killed, the parents have a right for a 14th Amendment claim.
And if we get past that, then my standard is that you have to show that the officer's use of force shocked the conscience. In other words, the officers did not, they had a purpose to harm, that they intended to harm, terrorize, or kill.
Well,
that's under our law.
Yes.
Reveals Osborne.
Correct. I'd like to.
What evidence do you have of that?
Well, I'd like to address that if I can. It is true that the Porter v. Osborne case says in the 14th Amendment you have this shock the conscience standard.
And it goes on further under Porter to say they intended to harm, they intended to terrorize, or they intended to kill.
I think the case then tries to differentiate situations where the officers have some time to deliberate, as opposed to situations where they do not. Obviously, if an officer has to make a split-second decision, they see someone what they think to be a gun in their hand. So,
doesn't the evidence show here that the officers were continually attempting to place the defendant in custody for the decedent? A legitimate law enforcement objective, and they didn't do anything without having that be their attempt.
Well,
their intent. Is there anything in here that says there's any intent in this situation except attempting to place the decedent in custody?
Well, I would argue it in twofold. One, I would say at a minimum there's a factual dispute if the officers had time to deliberate as they're continuing to tase. I can understand an argument, Your Honor, with perhaps the first tase, but once the decedent is down, pinned against a tree, with his arms underneath him, eventually four officers securing him to continue tasing him. The one officer for 92 seconds, as you, I'm sure, are aware, in order to get anything over 5 seconds, you have to keep the trigger pressed. In some of those tases, there's 13 seconds and 19 seconds, and then we have the simultaneous. So at that point, during that last part of the tasing, which led to his death, we would argue, number one, that the officers acted with deliberate indifference. And that standard applies. And it might be a factual question for a jury if they had time to deliberate.
Well, it's not a factual question because the judge is, first of all, going to give them the law. And I guess I'm still trying to figure out why our case of Porter versus Osborne makes it such that they would give them any indifference standard, because they would be talking about whether the officers intended to do something.
Well, I think the preliminary question would be whether the officers had time to deliberate. If they did, then the case says that the deliberate indifference applies. If they did not, then the case, as you previously stated, says there has to be a purpose to harm unrelated to a legitimate law enforcement objective. Quite frankly, I'm not sure anyone really knows what that means and how we out there is probably a discussion for another day. Clearly, officers were acting within the course of their work as police officers. There's no suggestion that they were sexually assaulting someone in the back of a car. But I think if something violates the Constitution, even the Fourth Amendment, excessive force, I think an argument could be made that that's not really related to a legitimate law enforcement objective. And although I would agree officers have a right to defend themselves, I think when you have a situation where they're trained that repeated and prolonged taser applications can cause someone's death, that was their admitted training on that point.
So we're talking about the facts under the circumstances, but there's no evidence of ulterior motives. There's no evidence of anything except you're suggesting that they had time to think about it. I realize what the time period was between the first time he was approached and they tried to arrest him. Until then, I realize what that time period, and you're saying that time period enough is enough for a question of fact.
I do, but beyond that, I would say once he's prone with his arms underneath him, particularly when the other officers arrive, he has weight on his back.
But the problem is with all of that argument is the arms underneath him is the same thing we had from the first. The arms underneath him or going for underneath or doing whatever he did, in each instance the officers believed that had to do with the firearm.
I understand that argument, Your Honor, but I think
that's not an argument. It's what they're suggesting.
It's what they're saying. Yes, I agree.
And I have I got no facts against it.
Well, the problem is you don't have any verbal threat by the decedent. You don't have any punch, any kick, any standing up. So all you have is him down on the ground. He says at some point, the taser video, stop tasing me and I can't move. And obviously a reasonable interpretation, the reason he couldn't get his arms out from underneath them is because, number one, he's being tased for 102 seconds and you can't do it while that's happening. And number two, he's got weight on his back and he's pinned against a tree. So really, the alleged resistance, if you think about it, after the initial going to the ground, is him essentially being immobilized by the taser. So, can I get back to the standing issue? Because I realize it's
being...
I'm sorry, I got departed, but I just wanted to point out that it doesn't apply to the 14th Amendment claim. And I think it was pointed out, well, that might be a different standard. In this case, and it's obviously, I practice primarily in California, and obviously in California, the successor in interest or the representative of the estate can bring a survival action. But we all know it's different in Nevada. You need to have actually the name of the administrator appointed and then named as a plaintiff. Unfortunately, in this case, and I'm not sure why this happened, at some point there was the father was appointed as the administrator, and then there was a motion with the court to file an amended complaint to list the estate as a plaintiff. There was a stipulation from defense counsel. The court granted the motion. Quite frankly, I think that may have given us a false understanding that we had it right. Here's the court granting a motion to allow us to amend.
I want to make sure I understand from your perspective what's required by Nevada procedure. So Jones's father petitioned the probate court for the appointment, is that correct?
Yes.
And then the probate court issued an order granting the appointment.
Yes.
And that doesn't appoint you. That's not sufficient. He has to then file the order in where?
Yes.
I believe
the step we missed is filing the order in the probate court. And that was done.
Not only the order, but the petition.
Right. That was done eventually, but it wasn't done in April. But it was done and included as part of our MSJ opposition.
So you did. You filed it in November, I think. Is that right?
Yes.
The petition filed in April. The order is granted.
That's
a U.S. Special Administrator, and then you failed to file it in probate court.
It was
about,
does file eventually in probate court, but not when it should have been.
It should have been filed immediately.
Absolutely.
And it is filed until 6 months later.
That's approximately correct. And there's no question in looking back at this, we should have done something differently. But we think if you look at the Moreland case, for example, this case is a little different because you had John Jones as a plaintiff. He had an amended complaint with the estate. He was eventually appointed, and the court was on notice of that. Now, obviously, if I had to do it again, at a minimum, I would have moved for 17A relief while the summary judgment motion was even pending. But we didn't do that, and we waited until after the ruling, and then we moved for relief. But the court never gave us a response, and then the time came to file an appeal, and then the court didn't have jurisdiction. So here we are. I think a case
It would be accurate to say that at the time of filing the amended complaint, which we have in front of us, that the petitioner was not authorized to file the complaint.
That's a great question. I don't know.
The reason I ask the question is standing is determined at the time the complaint is filed.
I agree, Your Honor.
When was the first amended complaint filed? And then I looked when he would have had any right to have standing, and it was after.
I think technically you're probably correct, because I think at the time that it was filed, we assumed that he did have the standing because that last step wasn't taken. I guess the point I'm trying to make, and I understand your concerns and the issues of my colleague who's opposing us, this is a death case. And so it seems to me, since John Jones was the plaintiff, was appointed at some point, the court was aware of this, it's an easy fix to at least get that worked out. We would hate to think that this whole case is going to be decided on that issue.
Well, it isn't the whole case, as you've already said.
Well,
it's only the Fourth Amendment claim.
Right, and a few other things. With qualified immunity, we feel, given the officer's training that they talked about, given the Bryant v. McPherson case that originally came out in June of that year, and then in November, the law was enough clearly established in conjunction with their own knowledge and training that repeated taser applications could cause death.
Let me ask you another question. If I try to get by that, it seems to me that the determination of the proper party to sue is not difficult.
I understood, Your Honor. Well, that's why I'm just addressing my
question. If it's not difficult, then I can't do anything about it. If it's understandable, I don't even know how I can say it's understandable.
Well, I think clear. Well, what do they say? Hindsight is 20/20. I think at the time it was understandable for the following reasons. There was obviously we got him appointed, so there was some understanding that he needed to be appointed. We filed this amended complaint that the judge signed off on and agreed to name the estate, so I think it's pretty obvious we thought at that point that's all we needed to do. Obviously, if we thought we needed to name him, not just as a plaintiff, the father, but as special administrator, we would have done that. So I think in that context, it's understandable. It certainly was a mistake. And I think it's one that under the liberality of 17A that could be cured and should be, we believe, for purposes of this case. Can I say a word about the state law claims?
Yes.
We believe there's clearly no immunity for the state law claims for two reasons. One, because the cases say that if there's any evidence, and remember, this is just the summary judgment stage of a constitutional violation. This discretionary immunity under Nevada law does not apply. If there's any evidence, whether it's Fourth Amendment violation or 14th, we believe, taking all the facts in our favor, there is. And the second prong, and I think it's Berkovitz, the Dahlberg test, the second prong is not met. And there's cases, I believe, we cited in that regards.
If I read Nevada law correctly, it says in the Gonzales versus Las Vegas Metro Police Department, the decision whether to arrest or detain relates to policy objectives and thus is protected under Nevada's discretionary immunity state law.
Well, there are other
So it seems to me that at least for the claims as relating to arrest or detain, they meet the standard.
It is possible with the detention crisis, however.
I guess the only one where I see where you might have an interest is in battery, because there is a case directly about battery that has nothing to do with the policy objectives.
That's correct, Your Honor. So it looks like I'm quickly running out of time here again.
I think you're over your time.
Yes. I'll make one more comment. We didn't do what we should have done to get it right. But I think if you look at the overall record that he was appointed, and we made the amended complaint, and we brought it to the court's attention in our MSJ op, and then again after the ruling, we tried to get it right. And I do think it's an understandable mistake. And we're hoping that you'll send it back so that the judge, we can fix that issue, and then the judge can consider the substantive issues. Now, if I have any time at the end, I'm sure I don't have any, but thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, Craig Anderson on behalf of Officers Hatton, English, and the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. The plaintiff's appellate argument is that the district court abused its discretion by failing to grant Rule 1783 relief. However, the plaintiff never
did the court ever rule on it.
Did the court ever rule on
the 1783 motion?
I didn't file the 17A motion. The motion for summary judgment that we filed.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about.
Okay.
I misheard you.
The argument is the Rule 1783 was never requested below. And in fact, when they were provided the opportunity in responding to our summary judgment, they took the position that we're standing on the pleadings. There is no defect here. So they're essentially.
I thought you filed the 17. Rule 17 motion afterwards.
They didn't file a Rule 17 motion. They filed a Rule 15 motion. And that was after judgment had been entered. And so Rule 15 motions cannot be considered after the court has been divested of jurisdiction. There's never been a Rule 17 motion filed in this case. The subsequent motion to amend the complaint after judgment had been ordered was pursuant to Rule 15. And I would also like to point out that the petition to appoint Mr. Jones has been filed, but the order appointing him to this day is not filed. As entered from the record 192 and 193, there is still no administrator appointed to this estate as we stand here today.
Yeah, what's lacking since the district court has obviously authorized it?
They need to file the order, and then there's some purely ministerial act.
Ministerial, then there's the time for appeal. They did file the petition. They forgot to file the order.
Correct. And so, technically, it's a very technical argument that there is still no administrator appointed as of this date.
And that has to be filed where? With the probate court?
With the probate court. And that's probably as far as I dare go, because I'm not a probate lawyer. So I couldn't speak with authority on that.
Well, that would easily be fixed, right?
Absolutely. And that was what our perception was. When we filed our motion for summary judgment, it was a thorough motion for summary judgment and about 70 pages, with the majority focusing on the merits. I had about 2 pages in there on the standing issue, believing the Rule 17A relief would be requested, and as the law says, they're entitled to a reasonable time. They didn't request it. They said, no, we're right. They're wrong. We're fine. We're resting on our pleadings. And so what they really did was tie the hands of the district court. What they're saying,
counsel, I'm a little puzzled, because he said that they to this day have never filed a motion under Rule 17, yet the district court addressed it. So how the district court rule a motion?
It was so spontaneous. The district court mentioned that the proper method would have been to raise a Rule 17 issue.
Okay. And then he addressed that on the merits.
Did he address the merits?
He addressed the Rule 17 on the merits because the district court addressed it on the merits. Or you're suggesting that there's a waiver because they've never filed a Rule 17 motion. The district court went straight to Rule 17 and addressed it on the merits. Shouldn't we address that?
I think the plaintiffs have weighed that argument. It was not one they raised below.
The case is they raised it in their briefs, right?
They did not raise it in the opposition to motion.
So got it. But the district court did raise it and based its judgment in part on Rule 17. So there's no relief I'm going to give them under Rule 17.
The district court. abused his discretion in denying Rule 17 relief that was not requested. So absolutely, this court could address it. And would you like to...
Why wasn't it an abuse of discretion?
It was not an abuse of discretion because, as Judge Smith pointed out earlier, naming the correct party was not difficult. The Moreland case in NRS 41.1...
So what? I mean, that's not the standard thing. That's not an understandable mistake. You yourself said you're not a co-rate lawyer. I mean, they thought they had done what was necessary. They made a mistake. Should the case like this involve you to death? Hinge on mistake made by that our case law seems to suggest opposite.
Well, just a Rule 17. The interpreting of Rule 17 says that once the issue is raised, the party is entitled to a reasonable amount of time to correct. So that issue was raised in our summary judgment motion. In their opposition, where they had a reasonable time to correct it, they said, we are standing on the pleadings, there is no defect. And so, at that point, the reasonable time had run. Then after they got the court's...
And that's what the district court bases the decision on?
No, the district court bases the decision...
Okay, so you keep talking about things that are not the base of the district court's ruling. We interviewed the district court's ruling. Telling us that the district court could have done something else and there was another basis is not helpful.
Okay, so what's just...
Particularly not helpful to your client.
And so what the district court found then was that determining the correct party was not difficult, that the plaintiffs never filed the proper paperwork during discovery, and that they never requested leave to amend. So the district court had three specific reasons why it was not granting the relief. Not difficult, paperwork not filed, and the relief was never requested. And those are sound grounds that, although you may disagree with it, it does not rise to a level of abusing the court's discretion. Because what the argument really is they didn't ask for the relief. They didn't want the relief.
Well, what was concluded they so deliberately threw the case?
I'm sorry?
I mean, what do we conclude from all this? That they deliberately abandoned the case?
No, that there was no one withstanding to pursue the claims during the entire proceedings in the district court.
I mean, can we conclude anything other than they sort of bungled their way and just couldn't figure it out?
Well, that would be a subjective understanding.
Well, what do you mean not understanding?
Well, the understanding is...
They deliberately threw the case?
No, it was briefed, and they read our arguments. They could have at that point said, they're right, we made a mistake, let us correct it.
I guess what we're talking about is a question of whether or not our case law is an understandable mistake. That's the issue, right?
Yes, and what the district court said is that it's not an understandable mistake because determining the correct party is not difficult, citing to the Moreland case and then the matter by statute 41.100. And so that was the district court's. And so I guess it's your determination whether that's an abuse of discretion for the district court to conclude that that made an unreasonable mistake. But that mistake was also coupled with the fact that they never requested the relief. So it is kind of a totality of these factors as to why the district court concluded. As the district court said in the order, the plaintiffs continue to act as if no defect even exists. So is the district court at that point supposed to say, this is relief you haven't asked for, this is relief you said you don't want, and I'm going to still give it to you even though you don't want it? Is that an abuse of discretion not to do that? And personally, I thought that they would ask for the Rule 17 relief in their opposition and it would be on the merits. That's why the merits were briefed so heavily. Because even if we go to the merits, as you were discussing under the 14th Amendment claim, before we even get to the 14th Amendment claim, they need to establish a 4th Amendment claim because of a lower standard, it's a reasonable standard, and whether the officers would have been protected by qualified immunity for both the seizure and the force that was used. And I think it's clear in this case that at a bare minimum, the officers in this case would be entitled to qualified immunity for their actions. This was a multiple tasing case that occurred during a time period when this court was addressing numerous tasing cases. This case happened.
None of them like this. All the tasing cases I've seen involved 5 or 10 second bursts. I've never seen a case where an individual was tased for guy is down, he's not made any threatening words or gestures, as best we can tell, and he's down, and he's saying, I can't move.
Okay.
And they keep chasing him.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not mean to interrupt you. Well, so then you have to
say, is this standard procedure in Las Vegas?
Well, I will tell you that it's no longer policy because of the subsequent chaos decisions. But what this is not part of the record, I apologize. But what police officers were doing during this time is tasers were initially considered to be low-level force. Okay, initially, that has changed now that they're intermediate force. And there was a practice that was called cuffing under power. When you couldn't get an individual handcuffed, officers were trained to try some, not dart mode, not the paralyzation taser mode, but drive some where you're just pressing the taser as a pain compliance tool into the suspect until handcuffing was complete. It's called cuffing under power. So an officer would tase under power until a person was cuffed. And now, because of the recent case law with the Mateos case and so on, Brian, that that's no longer policy. Brian came out 10 days before this decision. It was a dark mode case. But what Mateos and Brian, what clearly established law they make, is that it is not permissible to tase an individual who is not resisting. So as a passive resistance tool. But when you get into the cases involving Marquez, and there's even a more recent one in this circuit in May of this year, which I probably should supplement the record on a Rule 20K, Thomas versus Dillard, where the court found that tasing, the law is not clearly established when you're tasing a resisting individual. And when you say that Mr. Jones was not threatening, I would respectfully disagree. Officer Hatton really performed as an admirable police officer in getting up to the point where we're tasing. What changed the dynamic was you have a 6-foot, 230-pound Jones turning and confronting the 5-foot, 770-pound head. And the taser prongs are in the front. So Jones was clearly approaching and advancing on Hatton. So he may not be saying anything threatening, but he was acting threatening. And at that point, it became a physical altercation for this rather small officer. So
yeah, you have two or three officers on the scene chasing
you have four officers on this. They show up. You have Hatton alone during the majority of the tasing. Officer Juan Bueno arrives and is using his baton to try to pry the arm out. Officer English, when he hears the statement, there's something in his hand from Officer Juan Bueno, tases him once in the upper back with a drive stun that has no effect. He then moves to the left tricep, and then that's when the handcuffing occurred. But all of this occurred in less than 2 minutes. It's it's certainly a dynamic situation where the officer's sole purpose was to get him into handcuffs. And we're looking at it now with the benefit of 2020 hindsight. We know what happened. We're aware, obviously Officer Hatton was not aware that he was on lethal levels of cocaine, that this other stuff was going on. But if you look at the Marquez versus City of Phoenix case, that was 2013, the panel in the circuit found that 22 tasings was not unreasonable. It didn't even address the clearly established problem. And that case happened around the same time this occurred, which then it would obviously implied that it was not clearly established to Officer Hatton that multiple said in that case is that officers are immune for their use of force unless it is attributable to bad faith. And in this case, this is under Nevada law. This was Davis versus City of Las Vegas interpreting NRS 41.3.
When was that?
It was in 2007 by Judge Reinhardt.
Because we, well, yeah, but I have a Nevada case, Huffby and North Las Vegas Police Department, which is right from the state of Nevada. And it says the level or degree of force an officer uses does not relate to the policy objectives and is not protected by the discretionary immunity.
Huff is an unpublished decision, and there are other unpublished decisions that say that it is covered. And so I went with Davis in this case because it is a published decision binding upon this court, because Huff is not a published opinion. But it is certainly discretionary as to what type of force you're going to use. Are you going to use a baton? Are you going to use a taser? Are you going to use pepper spray? That becomes an issue of discretion or your fist. So the officer is using his discretion, and so they can only be stripped of their discretionary immunity if there's bad faith or similar to the shows the conscience standard in the Eiffel Moment. I know I'm out of time. If you want me to address the 14th Amendment claim or...
You have time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
I think you have time. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Yes, just very brief. I'll make a few comments and then I'll answer any questions that you have. First of all, so that it's clear, and I think it is from the record, once the two probes are in, from the initial tasing, when you drive stun the person in a third point in their body, there's an electrical circuit that goes throughout. So this really, for all intents and purposes, was getting the full circuitry through a darker probe mode. And agreeing with Judge Kaczynski, I mean, the amount of tasing, and I don't know if some of you have had a chance to listen or to see the video from the taser video, not only the duration of it, but the length of the consecutive tasings, really, in this case, is almost beyond belief.
Counsel, with respect to the Rule 17 question, what do you do? What is your response to the district court's finding that you have never requested leave to amend to cure this defect, and instead they, referring to the plaintiffs, act as if no defect exists?
Well, I think...
Did you ever ask the district court to correct what you understood that there was a mistake?
Yes.
When did you ask that?
After the ruling, well, what happened, and again, as I previously said, I wish that we would have done it during the pendency of the MSJ, but after the ruling came out...
Then you went to the
district court. But before the appeal is when we made the request.
And did you admit that you had made a mistake?
I think, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it'd be pretty clear, either explicitly or implicitly, that we got it wrong and that we wanted to get it right, because our concern at that time, and still our concern here, as has been discussed, is we didn't want the case to be decided on this technicality, which we really, to this day, believe was an understandable mistake.
Thank you.